history is full of examples of populations of Christians that were decimated, just like you shared about the Uyghurs. There was a Uyghur church at some point. The only evidence is archaeological. There were the Islamic persecutions that was not just the immediate violence of conquest, but it was also systematic violence through reducing Christians to status as dhimmis, that reduced Christianity to a permanent minority status. As strange as it sounds to say that we have rose-colored glasses about something like persecution, I do think that we need to regain perspective. Greetings and welcome to the Missions Podcast, the show that explores your hard questions on missions, theology, and practice to help goers think and thinkers go. I'm Alex Kochman, your host, joined again, as always, for another thrilling venture through the mine shafts and winding valleys and rivers and forest glens of missiology and theology by the one and only Scott Dunford, pastor of Western Hills Church in San Mateo, California. And we're so glad that you've joined us today. And if the conversation today is a blessing to you, go ahead over to your favorite podcast app and like the show, subscribe, leave it a positive rating and review. That'll help other people discover it. Scott, one of the blessings that we have, especially through our premium listening family, those who subscribe to Missions Podcast Premium, which you can do in your Apple Podcast app or at missionspodcast.com. But one of the blessings of that is being a part of an encouraging group chat of people that get it. I mean, people that are in hard places doing hard things. I had the privilege of getting together with one of our friends in that group who's a supporter of the show, who is doing some incredible ministry in the Middle East. And I wish I could tell you the half of what he's doing. And maybe someday we'll get him on here to do that. But until then, you'll just have to take my word for it. But he's thinking really, really critically about the relationship between the persecuted church, about missionary sending forces from overseas, coming into places of conflict where proselytizing, church planting, evangelism, where those things are illegal, thinking about how to do that in a maybe a legacy Christian context that's now overtaken by a different religious ideology. And so there's so much there that I think needs to be done. In fact, he wrote another question to me today that I thought was really challenging. But Scott, he sent an article our way today that I'd love to discuss. And it's a question we've had before. I've had several conversations. I know you have too in recent years. Some folks have asked, you know, I've heard that persecution is good for the church, that as Tertullian said, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. The question then, though, is what if that doesn't feel all the way true? And if persecution is so good for us, then why does Satan keep doing it to us? Hasn't he learned his lesson yet that persecution is only this unmitigated good? And, you know, I think a lot of us feel conflicted, Scott, because as Americans, we know we're too comfortable, we're too fat and sassy. And so we look at the world abroad that maybe has a church community that's suffering more than we are. And so we think, man, you know, they're so much more spiritual than me. And genuinely, oftentimes they are. And then at other times, though, we also see the way that the global church struggles and we see how blessed we are in comparison. And we wonder, you know, maybe the comparison is actually two directional. It's not just all one side having to learn from the other side. So he talked to us and sent an article this way. So if you're somebody that likes to read up on these things, Ronald Boyd McMillan in 2019 published an article, "Does Persecution Always Bring Growth? Global Persecutions Suggest Otherwise." This is from the International Journal of Religious Freedom, Volume 12, issues 1 and 2, pages 181 to 192. And the purpose of that article is to essentially answer that same question. And he's trying to get us to think not just about persecution, but also about the very real threat of what happens when the persecution works and what happens when a church actually goes extinct. What then? And so there's a lot there for us to dive into. But Scott, I know you've thought deeply in some of the places where you've served as a missionary, number one. But what do you think? Do we, this sounds like such a ridiculous question. Do we underemphasize the danger of persecution in praise of the martyrs of the past?
I think, you know, I was probably as guilty as anyone, you know, we think of persecution that doesn't affect us. And we think, wow, well, you know, those are better Christians than us. And it creates this little bit of a weird, you know, martyr syndrome where we, you know, I think of some of the books that I've read, you know, about persecution in China. And there's a little novel called Safely Home, you know, and it doesn't glorify suffering, but it does certainly, you know, shows this suffering as this way that God is bringing them to himself. And as I'm saying it, I'm hearing myself realizing, yes, of course God uses suffering to bring us to himself, but it doesn't mean that we should want suffering. And certainly when we hear about persecution going on in other places around the world, we shouldn't be celebrating it as if, oh, there's revival. And the article brings out this idea that sometimes people in those persecuted places, because of this kind of the theology of martyrdom and this that quote from Tertullian, causes people to go like, why isn't my church growing? And we're going through suffering, and yet we don't see us taking over this culture. We're not seeing the church necessarily growing in the way that we would expect it to grow in the timeline that we're expecting it to grow. And I think it's important. This article highlights this idea that there have been times in history where the persecution of the church simply led to its extinction, you know. You and I were talking offline, but it brings to mind the Uyghur church. And you're like, what Uyghur church? It's right, one of the exactly. least reached people groups in the world. And yet, as I was learning about the history of the Uyghurs, there is a history of Christianity in part of that area, more on the Church of the East influence. But there was a thriving church that was in those cities of Kashgar and Turpan and these other major places that was wiped out completely by the rise of Islam, and all the Christians were dead. And for many, many years, there were not Uyghur Christians in that part of East Turkestan. And so we know from history that there are times, look at the Islamic rise. And while the church has struggled and there's little pockets of Christians here and there, how much do you hear about the Saudi Arabian Christians?
None,
right? Because those tribes were destroyed, you know, like that were Christian at the time. And at one point, there were a lot of Arabic Christians. They did not have the Bible in Arabic, but now those people were just completely wiped out off the map. And of course, now there's more people coming to Christ, but those are new movements to Christ. So I think we have to be pretty circumspect as we kind of look back and think about this, how persecution really does change things, not always for the better.
Yeah. One of the helpful things in the article is the author undercuts that cause and effect assumption that we have, that just because there's persecution, the church has to automatically benefit from it. Yeah. And one of the things that he contrasts is short, intense persecutions versus longer systematic persecution. So, for instance, and this isn't maybe a perfect analogy, but in the wake of the assassination of Charlie Kirk, which was a very short, punctiliar act of violence against one very particularly outspoken Christian, we've had several people come to our church that just showed up on a Sunday saying, hey, you know, in light of everything that's happening, we know we need to be back in church. Maybe you've had a few in your church that are like that. So something that's very short and obviously tremendously violent, but limited in its scope, can have a refining effect. But he contrasts that with things that last generations, with things that are persecutions that are characterized by this systemic attempt to stamp out Christian witness across society. And he brings up a few historic examples that I'm sure we can walk through. But it's very easy to see how that over time is really going to weaken the church. Now, one of the things that I want to ask you about, I came across this preaching Acts 26, actually, this past Sunday. And one of the things that the Apostle Paul says about his time when he was a persecutor of the church is that he attempted to get the Christians to blaspheme, which shows kind of the weakness of the early church at that time, that they were at this real risk of actually blaspheming the Christ in which they obeyed. So stamping out the church or murdering Christians is not always the stated goal of persecution. Sometimes the goal is to get individuals to blaspheme or to apostatize, to leave the faith. And so what is the effect overall of some of these long-term intentional attempts to not just create martyrs, which, you know, when you create a martyr, you create a hero, Scott, but to create apostates? And what, from your study, has been the effect of that? How should we understand those types of systems when we're looking out at some of these cultures across the world?
Yeah, that was really interesting in the article because it brought up Decius and Roman Emperor around, I think it was around 250. Alex, you can check me on that. But his stated goal was to so weaken and undermine the church through forced, quote unquote forced. None of us are forced to blaspheme or to be apostate. But forcing sacrifices to the emperor. And by forcing sacrifice to the emperor, he thought he could destroy the church. And in many ways, he really did wreak a lot of havoc. And, you know, all the way up through the early fourth century, we're seeing tensions within the church. You know, the Donatist controversy is one of those things that kind of, I don't know if it's necessarily related to the Decius persecutions, but those persecutions where people ended up apostatizing, ended up tearing apart the church, even knowing how do we bring these penitent former apostates back into the church? Is it even possible to restore them? What about pastors who had apostatized? Can they be restored back into ministry? We think about modern examples, you know, of communist China and the Soviet Union, in which there was a forced, not a forced, but like a very like strong effort to weaken the church. We might call that like the castration of the church, you know, where it's okay to be a Christian, you just can't share your faith, or right. It's okay to be Christian, you just can't talk about it or go to church. You can privately in your own home believe whatever you want. We have religious freedom. Well, that doesn't go along with what the mandates of Christ, that we are supposed to be active and militant in our evangelism. Mm-hmm. So when the state does that, and the church capitulates to it, I think that's a real danger. And I wouldn't say this is a state desire to apostatize the church, but I think there's like, I think in social media today, there is an effort to do that. I think what we're seeing right now, the full court press by the Latter-day Saints. I mean, you and I were talking about this offline, but like my feed is full of Latter-day Saints arguing and debating. And I have a feeling it's a funded effort to get the word out that Mormons are Christians. We're not creedal. Well, that speaks to a lot of Baptists who don't want to call themselves creedal, you know, but we are Christians. Yeah. We love Jesus. We're disciples of Jesus. And look at all of our good fruit. We have good families. We do a lot of good works. Look at us, you know, chopping up trees after hurricanes, like, you know, by our fruit, you should know them. And you're like, what are you talking about? Like, and I think that immature Christians get sucked up into that. And they like the TikTok version of Mormon Christianity. And I think that can undermine the church as well.
Yeah, to your point, if Christians are willing to compromise on core doctrines just with the soft influence of a chorus of voices in media or social media, friends, peer groups, how much more so are Christians willing to compromise on core truths with actual threat of violence from the government, or if not physical violence, you know, debanking, the kind of unpersoning that we see happen in a modern industrialized society. A friend of mine who was a missionary in a particular Asian country that marginalized Christians, he pointed out to me one time, you know, in this country, it is illegal to share your faith. It's illegal to proselytize. And there is threat of persecution against Christians. And yet some of these ministries that collect data on persecution, you never see this country, his country, highlighted in red on some of these maps. And I asked why that is. And he said, well, because the church has learned to comply. He said one of his concerns with the national church is that they've learned to get along. They've learned that they can worship in peace, like you're describing, if they don't step out of line, if they're not sharing their faith, if they're not trying to win over and convert members of the majority people group who have to identify with the mainstream religion of that country and culture. As long as they stay in their lane, they are able to, in theory, exist as Christians. But, you know, as you kind of point out or allude to, we're called to do more than just exist in theory as Christians, you know, between our heads or between our ears. Being a Christian is more than just affirming something that stays a thought floating around between your ears and never gets expressed. To be a Christian is also to be a part of this mission of making disciples of all nations. And so do we really have the option to stay silent in that way? I would say not. But moving forward just a little bit, Scott, you know, another good question that we got from this listener, which I don't think we'll have time to exhaust today, but then the question becomes, all right, how do we think about religious freedom in some of these contexts as a goal of Christian missions? We have a tendency to say, once there's religious freedom, you know, that place is maybe less in need of the gospel. We should be taking the gospel to the hardest places of the greatest risk. And maybe that's a bit of an oversimplification. How should Christian missionaries focus on religious freedom? How do they promote that? What does that even mean? What is religious freedom? Because I think if we recognize anything out of this conversation, it's that if there isn't some semblance of an agreement in a society that you shouldn't be able to be outright killed, persecuted, arrested for your faith, if there isn't some baseline level of that, then the gospel ordinarily, and I want to emphasize ordinarily, God can work outside of the ordinary, but ordinarily the gospel won't go as far as it could otherwise. Even in Rome, in the first century, in the ministry of the Apostle Paul, how was he able to get the gospel from Jerusalem to Rome? While being persecuted by the Jews, sure, that was a catalyst for him to get the message to more people, but it was because he had the right as a Roman citizen to appeal to Caesar that he's able to go all the way to Rome and proclaim the gospel in all of the halls of power along the way, right? There was at least the idea in principle that Judaism is religio licita or licit religion, legal religion, and therefore Paul essentially argues in various places in the book of Acts that Christianity should be allowed as well, right? So there's at least the basis of a biblical understanding that ordinarily Christians should labor such that Christianity should be tolerated in a society.
Right.
We shouldn't seek out a position of marginalization. We shouldn't seek out a position of being persecuted. And it's not an enviable position. Sure, you're blessed if you're persecuted, Jesus says in the Beatitudes, but persecution itself is never commended in Scripture. Quite the opposite. Those who persecute God's people are judges. You know, like Herod Agrippa I is struck down in Acts 12, immediately dead, and is eaten by worms as retribution after the execution of James. And so the persecutors and the persecution itself are never commended in Scripture. So, Scott, we need some level of religious freedom, right? What does that look like for us on the mission field?
Well, I mean, I think that's a position that Baptists have long taken, but it's because in our history, we were persecuted, you know, we were, when we came out of the Puritan movement, there was persecution because we weren't part of the established church in England and Germany and other places. We come to America and in the colonies with the established congregational churches, we were not also part of a state church. And so again, we felt persecution, and we believe that the ability to freely share our faith and to live our faith in this free exchange of ideas is going to allow the gospel to flourish. And then when it's a design of Satan to prevent the free exchange of the truth. And when the state gets involved in that idea of prohibiting truth, or at least the truths that they don't find convenient to the moment, that it's going to stop the free proclamation of the gospel. And so I think, you know, certainly at least, I realize that's a summary that could be taken apart and parsed in a million ways, but I'm trying to just summarize why I think this is such a big deal. And so as much as a Southern Baptist, I'm part of a Southern Baptist church. A few years ago, they had this resolution, and the resolutions are toothless and they're frustrating because they don't really do much, but they made a statement about the persecution of Uyghurs, even though they're Muslims in Western China. And I had Uyghurs talk to me about that, and we're thrilled that happened because it gave some legitimacy to their cause. Well, why would a Baptist care about that? Well, because we want them to be free to hear the gospel, you know, not that we want them to be continuing in their Islam, which leads to death, but we want them to have the freedom to be able to listen to ideas and to share the gospel. And if they're being persecuted and wiped out, they're not going to be able to hear the gospel. And it just goes along even with just the idea of human dignity. And so I think that's one way that as Christians are listening and seeing persecution around the world, whether that's for sure with our Christian brothers and sisters, but also with anything that's going to prohibit the exchange of ideas. We see that as something that's going to be detrimental to the spread of the gospel. And so I think highlighting it, bringing attention to those things, letting our people know that often are very ignorant of the things that are going on around the world. And it's not even their fault. I mean, there's just so much to keep track of. It's overwhelming. But when a Christian missionary can say, hey, I'm here in India, for instance, and Christians are being silenced and persecuted, and Hinduism is being promoted on a very militaristic level, mm-hmm. That we can put pressure on governments to stop that. And have you noticed, Alex, you and I have been like pretty active in reposting Nigerian persecution since our episode that we did on that. And for a long time, no one was saying anything about it. And then all of a sudden, one congressman, then another congressman, now there's a number of congressmen highlighting Nigerian persecution of Christians. Yeah. And I think, I'm not saying you and I did that. Far from it. I'm not saying that. But I do think that Christians highlighting the needs of other Christians can bring the powers that be. And, you know, by God's grace, America is still a force in this world and still has a heart and an ear toward Christian needs and desires and freedoms. And when they put their weight behind it, that can make a difference on the world scale.
Yeah. And I would say I'm seeing the same thing. I'm seeing more people talk about the plight of Nigerian Christians. I'd say not enough, but I'd say to whatever extent there's been people waking up, I can usually find that those people that are waking up are maybe within two or three degrees of a conversation with Judd Saul, who we had on this show. So he's done just a tremendous job of drawing attention to the needs of the believers in Nigeria. But so much more awareness needs to be brought about. I think the same. Maybe on a lower level, because I don't hear people catching on to this idea, but the persecution of Christians in Europe that Joel Veldkamp joined us to speak about in Azerbaijan and into Asia there in that part of the world, and talking about the conflicts that are there with the Armenian Christian, Armenian, excuse me, Christian genocide.
They might be Armenian, but I don't think so.
I think they're Armenian and not Armenian.
Yes.
But, you know, history is full of examples of populations of Christians that were decimated, just like you shared about the Uyghurs. There was a Uyghur church at some point. The only evidence is archaeological. The article made the point that something similar happened under the Emperor Decius. There were the Islamic persecutions that was not just the immediate violence of conquest, but it was also systematic violence through reducing Christians to status as demis, through taxation, through other things that reduced Christianity to a permanent minority status in Islamic lands. You had the Mongol persecutions, which erased much of Christianity from Asia and really made it such that Europe was the last holdout of Christianity after the 15th century. And of course, you have, since the rise of communism, atheistic regimes that sought to do something similar and in a few parts of the world are still doing something similar. And of course, places like China and North Korea come to mind as well. So as strange as it sounds to say that we have rose-colored glasses about something like persecution, Scott, I do think that we need to regain perspective. You cannot erase a church and expect it to grow. And when I see people carelessly and flippantly, maybe just if we can bring some application, when I hear flippant comments in our culture, like, you know, it's a good thing that we're in the negative world or that Christians are experiencing pressure on this front or that front, even in our own society, much less in a foreign mission field. You know, it's a good thing because that will, you know, strengthen the church in some way that could be true. God can take what man means for evil and use it and mean it for good. Genesis 50:20, he works all things according to the counsel of his will. But that doesn't make those things good as ends in themselves.
Right.
And the good that God brings out of it doesn't necessarily mean that the temporal people of God, the church militant on earth, will actually do better. It might mean generations of setback. The type of good might just be bringing some of his saints to enjoy eternity with him sooner. So we should not treat persecution flippantly. And what I want to do as we head into the overtime episode, Scott, is talk about how do we not just persecution proof our Christianity. Of course, we can't perfectly do that. All that desire to live a godly life in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. But how do we specifically extinction proof our Christianity? How do we make sure that even in the worst case scenario, if everything was taken from us, that the faith that we have remains, that we're planting deep roots? So we can talk about that in our final segment. But Scott, I want to give you just a minute or two here to share some closing words. What do you think is the most important takeaway from an article like this, and just recognizing that a lot of us have this overly optimistic perspective on persecution, which just in general in world history, if persecution were good for the church, Satan wouldn't do it so much. The fact that Satan keeps stirring up persecutions against the church must mean it's accomplishing something for the kingdom of darkness. And we should at least take that seriously as a formidable foe that we should pray and labor against.
Yeah. I mean, I would say two things. One, there is an idea that it is what it is, right? We know that phrase. And I think when we're going through persecution, we have to understand that this persecution is not outside the control of God. In some way, it's been ordained by God for our good. And we can rejoice in suffering, like over and over again, the epistles call us to do, right? It is our joy to be able to fill up the sufferings of Christ on your behalf, you know, as the scriptures say, we take up our cross. That doesn't mean though, that we want those things like that we're not pushing back against persecution where we can. There's a difference. So when we're going through it, we embrace it as God's will for our life. But that also means that doesn't mean or correlate to the idea that we need to keep pushing it for religious freedom and for the gospel to be able to have free reign and to be able to go forward with freedom and with power and with might and also to be deeply prayerful and advocating for our brothers and sisters around the world that are facing those persecutions.
And, you know, if you think about it, the gospel, it was there, it was present in the world, it was changing the world from the time of Christ and the apostles all the way up through the Roman persecutions, all the way up to Constantine. And yet, when Christianity was legalized through the Edict of Milan, when it was tolerated, and then when it eventually became the official empire of the Roman official religion of the Roman Empire, you can argue, okay, did things get mixed up in a way that maybe they shouldn't have, perhaps? But there's no underestimating the fact that that led to the long-term, sustainable, explosive growth of the faith. God can work in and through the church when Christianity is suppressed, but he can also work when it's legal and permitted and tolerated and even promoted. And God can do far more than we can ask or think. We shouldn't try to make things harder for him, though. We should do, as Deuteronomy 29:29 says, the revealed things belong to us. We don't know how God's working behind the scenes secretly in history to bring good out of evil. But we do know that it's our responsibility to stand up for truth, to stand up for the freedom of our brothers and sisters in Christ, and to speak to rulers in society and say that it's your duty before God, to whom you're accountable, to be a blessing to the people of God and to the gospel of Jesus Christ and not a hindrance to it. So there's a lot for us to think and pray soberly about in that discussion. Again, for our premium subscribers, we want to talk now about how do we extinction-proof our own ministries. Maybe some of you are serving in mission fields where, you know, that's a real risk. And you need to think about how do you extinction-proof your ministry if you're kicked out of the country and No one else is there to pick up the baton in your absence. And so we'll explore all of that and more at missionspodcast.com/premium or in your Apple Podcast app. You can subscribe and get access to that exclusive bonus episode. And before you go, remember to leave us a positive rating and review in your podcast platform of choice. If you have any questions or suggestions, email alex@missionspodcast.com. And remember, the Missions Podcast is a ministry of ABWE. To take your next steps in the Great Commission and taking the gospel to the nations, go to abwe.org. Until our next conversation, go make disciples of all the nations. Hey, listeners, we know you believe in missions. Otherwise, you probably wouldn't be listening to or watching this show. But have you ever wondered what your next step with the Great Commission should be? Maybe the Lord is leading you to serve somewhere yourself. Maybe the Lord is calling you to be a part of sending someone from out of your own church. Well, wherever you are with missions, if you're ready to get serious and find what your next step is, ABWE's 24-hour demo event is for you. Now, it's great to listen to a podcast about missions, but there's nothing that beats the in-person fellowship that can only take place face-to-face, where you're alongside other people that are in your similar station of life, thinking and praying together about your next step. So if you want to join us at our next event, they happen all throughout the year at our Harrisburg, Pennsylvania-based international headquarters. You can go to demo.abwe.org. Again, that's demo.abwe.org, and use the promo code podcast for a discount on your registration fee. So it takes all excuses away. What are you waiting for? Come find your next step with the Great Commission at demo.abwe.org, promo code podcast.